In our discussion last night, we went into some detail on a question of bureaucratic centrism and the question of Thermidor and Bonapartism. Now, and because of the pressure of time, I passed very briefly over the actual process that occurred. And some comrades called it to my attention later, and I realized that perhaps I was a little too brief. And I want to begin tonight then by elaborating at some length in the about the process, because I raised a problem. Now, the problem was, did the conclusion that Trotsky drew in 1934, as presented in his article of 1935, the conclusion that the Comintern and the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was dead, and therefore the term bureaucratic centrism no longer was applicable, necessity for a new international, a new party in the Soviet Union, and a political revolution. Whether 1924 was the day, I'm afraid I left that impression. 1924, Trotsky said, fixes the date of the beginning of Thermidor. Let me give you the quote again. Quote, the year 1924, that was the beginning of the Soviet Thermidor. The Thermidor of the Great Russian Revolution is not before, but already behind, far behind. And then he concludes, the Thermidorians can celebrate approximately the 10th anniversary of their victory. The Thermidorians can celebrate approximately the 10th anniversary of their victory. Now, the events from 1924 to 1928, actually from 1923 to 1928, were really decisive. Constituted a real turning point in the degeneration of the Comintern and Communist Party of the Soviet Union and the consolidation of the power of the Stalinist bureaucracy and the emergence of Soviet Bonapartism. Stalinist Bonapartism. The German Revolution of 1923, which was defeated primarily because of the policy of the Comintern. An objective revolutionary situation existed, conceded by everyone. A Communist Party that had behind it the support of the majority of the German working class, temporized, vacillated, refrained from throwing its forces into action, and missed the opportunity, and led to a defeat of the German Revolution of 1923. And paradoxically, the defeat of the German Revolution strengthened the Stalinist bureaucracy in the Soviet Union. It strengthened the bureaucracy because the Russian working class had been looking eagerly to support from the West, from some advanced proletariat, the revolutionary class in the West, especially Germany, to come to its assistance, that had gone through a period of incredible suffering, famine, civil war, for a whole period. And this defeat tended to destroy the hopes and the aspirations, especially of the advanced revolutionary elements of the German working class, of the possibility of looking beyond the borders of the Soviet Union for assistance in the preservation of the October Revolution and the consolidation of the of their dictatorship. The centrist bureaucracy in the Comintern and in the CPSU insisted that the German defeat of 1923 was just a temporary phenomenon. They said the revolutionary wave is continuing to mount and not proceed, as the left opposition insisted that it would after such a defeat. And this led them to a number of ultra-left adventures, culminating in an additional defeat. In 1924, the Young Communist Party of Estonia engaged in a putsch, threw the small Communist Party into an action to conquer power in the state behind the backs of the Estonian working class, without their knowledge and without their support, and it resulted in a catastrophe. In Bulgaria, the Communist Party stood aside while a counter-revolutionary offensive was launched against the Peasant Party, then in a majority in the state, took a position of a plague on both your houses, resulting in the victory of the counter-revolution and the launching of a white terror in Bulgaria that decimated the Communist Party there. Each of these defeats, I say, serves paradoxically to strengthen the bureaucracy, because the masses of the Soviet Union lost faith then in the capacity of the workers of Europe to come to their aid, and facilitated then the promulgation of an acceptance of the theory of building socialism in one country as relying upon our own forces and own resources. Now, this left turn was then followed by a right swing a right-wing zigzag in which the Communist Party of China was sent into the Kuomintang on the theory that China was confronted with the question of a national democratic revolution. The theory of the revolution in stages, that the first stage of the revolution was the democratic revolution, and therefore the Communist Party had to be subordinated to the national bourgeoisie, that is Chiang Kai-shek and his Kuomintang. And then they engaged in such adventures of establishing the Peasants International, picking up and touting various peasant leaders as revolutionary, proletarian internationalists, engaging in such adventures as the La Follette adventure here, where they entered into the La Follette movement and captured the so-called Labor Party, in which they succeeded only in capturing themselves and led to disaster. Now, I deliberately applied the term bureaucratic centrist to the bureaucracy in this period because, remember, Zinoviev and Kamenev were part of the Stalin faction, the Stalin center faction. As a result of these developments on an international scale, the Zinoviev-Kamenev left wing of the Stalin center faction broke with Stalin and joined the left opposition to form the United Left Opposition. It was the United Left Opposition that published the program of the left opposition, which was published in by Eastman, wasn't it? The real published under the title "The Real Situation in Russia," which is the program of the left opposition, with some concessions on China because of the Zinovievists that were later, of course, repudiated by Trotsky. With the establishment of the United Opposition, The Stalin faction blocked with the right wing, the right opposition of Bukharin, Rykov, and Tomsky, headed by Bukharin. And it was this right wing that organized the Sixth World Congress. It was Bukharin who wrote the draft program of the Communist International, which was submitted to criticism by Trotsky in his criticism of the draft program. And it was therefore the first time that the concept of building socialism in a single country was entered into the program of the Communist International. In 1927, Zinoviev, Kamenev capitulated, brought back into the party. The left opposition was crushed, imprisoned, exiled, expelled from the Communist Party. Now then, the situation was that it was after the Sixth World Congress that split with the right opposition took place, and the Bukharinites were crushed. And there was no, then later, after that, there was no open, avowed opposition, either in the Soviet Union or in the Communist Party, with the crushing of the Bukharin opposition that had come out of the original Bolshevik cadre under Lenin. So you could say that in 1928, or rather, after the crushing of Bukharin, Rykov-Tomsky, the right opposition, that the Communist Party of the Soviet Union had already been totally bureaucratized and rendered impotent as a viable force for revolution. The Comintern accepted this eclectic program, as say, containing the formula of building socialism in one country. But although the left opposition had been expelled from the party in the Soviet Union and throughout the entire Communist International, Trotsky insisted that the left opposition still remain as a part of the Communist International. You know, he appealed over the heads of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union to the Comintern, because schematically, the Comintern was the highest and most authoritative body of the entire international movement, and the Russian Communist Party was just one section of the Comintern. Trotsky utilized every legal opening to present his point of view to the world communist movement. That is the way, for example, that's the way Comrade Cannon got hold of a copy of the criticism of the draft program at the Sixth World Congress. He says, we still remain as a section of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, of the Comintern. Now who's sabotaging our meeting? Some Stalinist out there. And the policy was one of reform. That is, to reform the Communist Party, the Comintern, and the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. When the American Trotskyists first established their group here, named the Communist League of America, for the whole period from 1928 until 1933, they functioned as a faction of the American Communist Party, not as an independent party. Now the question, would it be correct to say then that in 1929, with the Comintern completely bureaucratized under Stalin, the Stalinist domination, with the opposition both left and right crushed inside the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, that would be the time, would have been the time to have declared that these parties are dead, they're not viable, that we declare that bureaucratic centralism gives way to Soviet Bonaparte. Well, in my opinion, I think it would if it had not been for one more very important factor. And that was that looming on the order of the day was the German crisis. If you recall in the series of pamphlets that the old man wrote on Germany, he called on Germany the key to the international situation. He still refused to write off the German working class. Intervened vigorously in the policy against the third period insanity in which the German working class is divided right down the middle by Stalin's theory of social fascism, that the social democracy and fascism were twins, not antipodes, and that you could have no united front with social fascism. I can only speculate he decided that we must go through this one more historical test before we finally close the door on our previous policy of holding out the hope of reforming these organizations. But with the defeat in Germany, without a struggle, with the victory of Hitler, to him that was the decisive fact. Then, as I said yesterday, from that point forward, the term bureaucratic centrism disappears. I don't recall Trotsky using it after 1933 or 1934. Now, I said that the one thing that identifies Stalinism as a world tendency, in the world working class movement, is the embracing of the theory of socialism in a single country. Let me read an interchange which appeared in the case of Leon Trotsky, an interchange between John Dewey, who was the head of the commission investigating the Moscow trial, on this particular point. Dewey to Trotsky. Now, I wish to ask you a question more on the line of your theoretical position, about a question involved in the struggle of the left opposition. Why did the question of socialism in one country and the world revolution become such a fundamental point of division? Trotsky. Because the theory of socialism in one country signifies in our eyes the repudiation of internationalism. We consider internationalism not as an abstract idea, but as the first interest of the workers' movement of the world, not for the purpose of building an independent, isolated socialist state. Then the Russian worker would not have a vital interest in connection with the workers of other countries. Dewey, was that a theoretical objection based upon a general theory? Trotsky, yes, theoretical, and at the same time practical. Because the international policies of the Stalin government are directed against the interests of the international proletariat. And more than that, as I tried to explain, I believe yesterday, Stalin himself changed his position during 1 year. That is, during the year 1924. In the spring of the year, in his Problems of Leninism, I think, you're the expert, Lou, is it? Problems of Leninism, the book of Stalin's compilation of Stalin, I think that was the title. In the first issue of the book published, he rejected the theory, possibility of building socialism in one country. It was published in April 1924. In the fall, another issue of the book was published with just the exact reverse statement. The possibility and necessity. Desirability of building socialism in the Soviet Union. Of course, the first edition was repressed. Anybody caught with a copy was ipso facto declared to be a Trotskyist, and sent to Siberia. Dewey, that is in the record. Trotsky, why? Because they substituted for socialism, for the idea of socialism, the regime of the solidarity of all the population, substituted for that idea the idea of a satisfied bureaucracy. They named that socialism in one country. What we named deformation of the worker state, they named socialism in one country. It was the question of the essence of socialism itself, and that's what's involved in the entire dispute. The essence of socialism itself is involved in this basic revisionism of the international character of the workers' movement, of the impossibility of carving out of the world one section and saying we're going to build socialism here while reaction, capitalism, military dictatorship reigns throughout the rest of the world. And under the banner of socialism in one country, the bureaucracy grew to monstrous proportions, destroying the Soviets and the party, transforming the Comintern into a frontier guard of the Soviet state, subordinated the communist parties and revolution abroad to the interests of the Soviet bureaucracy, first emasculated and then dissolved the Communist International, led a whole series of defeats which laid the basis for the outbreak of World War II, then fought the war as a great patriotic war around the slogan of kill Germans, led ineluctably to the jettisoning of revolutionary internationalism in favor of peaceful competitive coexistence, defense of the status quo, the parliamentary road, to the whole bag and baggage of reformism, which stinks to high heaven. I was going to say Bernsteinism. Bernsteinism would be a left winger in the Communist Party. Now, does this mean that Stalinism has not changed, does not change, will not change? Not at all. There have been significant changes. And I might say that the theory of socialism in single country has spawned changes that never dreamed of by the bureaucracy and is giving them problems that keep them awake at night. Because if you can build socialism in the Soviet Union, why not in Albania? Why not in Romania? Why not in Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, and Hungary? Yes, why not? And certainly in China, with its 700 million people and its vast resources, why not in China? And they asked themselves, why not? And they answered, of course we can. Of course we can, at the expense again of the world revolution. Now, all of these changes have spawned various theories. The theory that Stalinism died with Stalin. The theory that Stalinism equals the Moscow trial. There haven't been any Moscow trials anywhere else, with the exception of some miniature Moscow trials in Eastern Europe. Therefore, you don't have Stalinism. The theory that there cannot be a repetition of the historical circumstances that gave rise to Stalin. The theory that the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and the fake de-Stalinization campaign end of Stalinism and so forth and so on. No. These indicated changes, but not any essential change in the nature of Stalin. Now, there were great changes that were occurring in the Stalinist world in the transition from monolithism to polycentrism. Monolithism applied to that period in the development of Stalinism when the Soviet Union was the only existing workers' state. And therefore, utilizing prestige of the October Revolution, its authority and its power, converted the entire world communist movement, as I say, subordinated it to the interests of the Stalinist bureaucracy. Now, the first break in this monolith occurred with the Yugoslav Revolution. I'll go in a little detail here because it's important. It was one of those instances cited yesterday, which raised the question, how could we reconcile the position of Trotskyism, that Stalinism was counter-revolutionary, when here was a Stalinist party who led a successful revolution, first in Yugoslavia. And I pointed out that such a happenstance was foreseen and provided for in the transition program. When Trotsky wrote the transition program, a section was stated that under special and under unique and extraordinary circumstances, a Stalinist party could lead a successful revolution. And I submit that the conditions in Yugoslavia were both unique and extraordinary. There was a world war in progress. Yugoslavia was occupied by the Nazis, by the German troops. The resistance movement in Yugoslavia, resistance to the German occupation, was divided. One wing led by somebody else by the name of Mihailovich, I think, he led it with what they called the Chetniks, which had the support of the Allies, including Stalin and the Soviet Union. Another wing was led by Tito, the partisan. And there was a civil war raged between these groups that were conducting a resistance to the German occupation. Now, in the process of this civil war, again, as a matter of elementary survival, the partisans were compelled to take on a fight against two fronts, to destroy the Chetniks in order to conduct a effective struggle against the German occupation. Because the Chetniks, representing the national bourgeoisie of Yugoslavia, were in greater fear of their own revolutionary working class than they were of the Nazis who were occupying their country. The same that held true in China under Chiang Kai-shek. And Tito and the partisans emerged victorious. It was a surging revolutionary movement. The struggle was a national struggle for independence from the occupation of foreign troops, involving whole sections of the population outside of the working class. They did take power, and they did establish a deformed workers' state. I think I'll have just time for one more point, if we have to conclude at 9. And so I'll go into the question of structural assimilation.
Wait, you can talk till 9, then we can have questions for half an hour. We have to be out of here at 9:30.
Well, I'm not concerned about the period of questions. I don't ask those, you know. I'm concerned about what I have to say. Yugoslavia represented the break in the monolith because you had a communist party that had captured state power. And their base was no longer in the Soviet Union, the Soviet bureaucracy, it was in the national state. upon which they were fixed. Now, that was followed by, then, the establishment in Eastern Europe of a number of coalition regimes artificially imposed upon the various Eastern European countries as part of the series of pacts in Tehran, Yalta, and Potsdam between Stalin, Churchill, Roosevelt, the big three. Zones of influence, spheres of influence, Part of the agreement was that there would be no socialist overturn in Europe. And so Stalin established these coalition governments artificially. That is, the real power in the countries was the Soviet Red Army. And even crushed the whatever native working class revolutionary upsurges occurred as the Red Army advanced into these countries, were suppressed by the Red Army. Didn't want any independent revolutionary states established in Eastern Europe. He wanted them established under the immediate aegis and control of the Red Army. These coalition regimes then raised the question in the Fourth International. There was our big discussion over the question of Eastern Europe. And in the prior to 1948-49, when these coalition regimes were unceremoniously booted out and the foreign workers' state established, the comrades arrived at a formula to characterize these states. What were they? Capitalist states, but capitalist states occupied by the Red Army. Trotsky had said that in the event that the Soviet Union occupied countries contiguous to the borders of the Soviet Union and maintained capitalist property relations in those countries, we would have to reconsider our whole position on the question of the degenerated worker state. That is determined on Bonapartism. You recall the analogy that of the French Revolution, where under Bonaparte, the reaction did not restore feudal property relations. It was based upon the new property forms established by the French Revolution. So they arrived at what was a sort of a compromise formula. They said these were capitalist states on the road to structural assimilation with the Soviet Union. Capitalist states on the road to structural assimilation with the Soviet Union. The contradiction in terms, I think. Then, when the Cold War broke out, and Stalin decided in the necessity of the defense of the Soviet Union against the threat of American imperialism and the Marshall Plan in Europe, to boot the bourgeoisie out of the coalition government and establish worker states, then the formula was altered. They said then, these are states in which structural assimilation has been completed. Now wait now. Because, there's a certain logic to the form, because they have adopted as a model the Soviet forms of production, that is, socialist forms of production. And bureaucratized state formation. They identified structural assimilation with the adoption of the same pattern of economic and political organization that existed in the Soviet Union. Now, in the original program of the Bolshevik Party, the October victory was looked upon as the beginning of the world revolution. Nobody ever dreamed at that time of even hinting or suggesting of possibilities building socialism in a single country. Lenin, the Bolsheviks, reiterated over and over again that the Soviet Union cannot exist indefinitely side by side with world capitalism, that one or the other would have to prevail. Either the revolution would be extended to Europe and then to the rest of the world, or the Soviet Union would be crushed. When they established the Soviet Union, they established it as a federation of socialist Soviet republics, not of Russian Soviet republics, of socialist Soviet republics. And they looked to Germany, especially to Germany, and to the German Revolution to come to the assistance of the backward, terribly backward Russian state, holding open the inclusion within the federated socialist Soviet republics of a German federated Soviet socialist republic. That is, of assimilating into the structure of the Soviet state those areas or those revolutions, especially those contiguous to the Soviet Union, as part of the United Federation of Socialist Soviet Republics. That was the perspective. That was why the form, the federated form, was adopted in the very beginning. Now, a different form of assimilation took place. That was in the case of countries like Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. Those Baltic countries were assimilated into the structure of the Soviet Union, and they are now part of the Federated Socialist Soviet Republic. Okay. Different than the relationship that existed between the Soviet Union and the East European countries. But Stalin never had any intention of proceeding to the structural assimilation of East European countries, not at all. Not from the very beginning. In the beginning, he resorted to a policy of pillage and plunder of these countries. He even sliced off a section of Romania and assimilated that to the Soviet Union. setting up joint stock companies, exploiting these countries for the purpose of building socialism in the Soviet Union. Now, he could get away with that, as I say, up to a certain point. By the way, I may add that the break with Tito in 1948, the break occurred over the attempt on the part of Tito to promote the idea of a Danubian federation. I recall in the dispute in the party over the East European question, one of the objections that Ernest Mandel made to designating these states as reformed workers' states was that the impossibility of developing a planned economy on the basis of the Balkanized states in Eastern Europe. He says it was too narrow based for a planned economy. Without a planned economy, you cannot have nationalization of the basic means of destruction. He later changed his position, but he had a certain point. Tito saw this problem and tried to resolve it by advancing the idea of a Balkan federation. That is, a federation of Balkan states, which would begin, actually, to plan on a Balkan-wide basis, to begin the planned economy on a Balkan-wide basis, which would be a more adequate basis for building a socialist, in quotation, society. But Stalin saw this as an immediate threat to the domination of the Soviet bureaucracy in the Soviet Union. And so he began the big offensive against Tito, in which before Tito had been an ally, Tito became Tito the traitor, Tito the Trotskyist, Tito the scoundrel and the fiend. He tried to destroy Tito and did not succeed. Now, at the root, they say, at the root of the schisms that have occurred in the Soviet bloc has been this concept of socialism in a single country. Because socialism in the building socialism in the Soviet Union now, after the 23rd World Congress, they say socialism has been already completely built here. We're now proceeding in the transition from socialism to communism, if you please, in a single country. Planning is done through ComCom, the economic organization of the Soviet states, but it's done on the basis of favoring the Soviet Union against the other states. Division of labor, which is a problem that arises in the socialization of the means of production on an extended scale. Division of labor is set by the Soviet bureaucracy or attempted to. That was the thing the Romanians revolted against. In the division of labor, in the system of so-called socialist states, they wanted to assign Romania to developing agricultural products or oil. And they revolted. They wanted to build their own socialist society in Romania, in a single country. So polycentrism as it has developed in those areas of Stalinism in which the Stalinist parties have taken state power, can be traced directly back to this pernicious theory of socialism in a single country. Instead of including at least East Europe within the system of socialist states, they kept them on the outside and planted the seeds of this division, which is going to grow sharper. These contradictions will grow more acute as time goes on. With China, it entered in my opinion, as one of the important aspects of the Sino-Soviet dispute. The idea of building communism in the Soviet Union, while China was faced with a very acute economic problem with a tremendous, a growing population, inability to feed its own people. The demand for material aid from the Soviet Union. Say, no, we can't do that. We can't give you too much because we're building communism here, you see. You wait. When we get communism, then we'll take care of you. That didn't satisfy Mao and company. And so it went from one thing to another until, as I say, it's on the point of erupting into actual warfare. I'm going to skip over. I want to get to the question of Stalinism in this country. A question that I raised yesterday, and that is the perspective of the revolutionary development in the United States. And, you know, we have speculated. We began a discussion in the party in 1938. We're right at the very year of the founding of the Socialist Workers Party, on the perspective of the development in this country, revolutionary development. It was that time that we adopted our Labor Party position. Previous to that, we were opposed. We opposed the advocacy, the slogan of advocating the formation of an independent labor party based upon the trade union. It was only on the basis of the development of the CIO and the fact that the American working class did not then go beyond the trade union form of organization that posed the question of what political form will the radicalization of the workers take in this country? Will it go through, will it ignore the existing organizations, that is the trade unions, go around them, over their heads, into the Revolutionary Party? And the Trotsky answered, no, he didn't think that it would be the likely or probable course of development, that the workers tended to operate through their own organization, at least to try first through their own organization before abandoning their organizations for some other organization. So it appeared then as though the Labor Party development would be the most probable development of the politicalization of the American working class. Well, then that question raised the question of program. On what program? Well, in our Labor Party position, we supported and do support the idea of the formation of an independent Labor Party based upon the trade union, even though we recognize that at least in the beginning it will be controlled by a reformist bureaucracy. We abstract from the program and say, on the basis of its working class composition, we will support such a political formation. Now, it's been very long delayed. We never said that the Labor Party will be the inevitable form. No, that has never been our position. All we said it would be is that it will be the probable form, that probably this would be the most likely course of development through the trade unions to a political party based upon the trade union movement. Now, if in the period of radicalization, the American labor bureaucracy is able to prevent the development of an independent political party expressing the interests of the American working class, if the explosive contradictions become so acute, if the tempo of the radicalization becomes so rapid, it is not excluded that the working class will go around, over their bureaucratized unions into a revolutionary political party. We do not exclude that course of development in the perspective of the American Revolution. What then is the perspective for reformism of the Stalinist variety or the Socialist Party variety in this country? Very dim, in my opinion. Very dim. I think that it is excluded that the working class will go through a lengthy and extended period of reformism in this country, similar to that of the working class in Great Britain. That the tempo of revolutionary development on a world scale will impart such an explosive quality to the radicalization of the working class in this country that the period of reformist experience will be very abbreviated if it occurs at all. And it will not go through the reformist Communist Party or the reformist Socialist Party. It's still the most probable course would be a brief experience with a reformist Labor Party and into the revolutionary Marxist Party. We have every reason to anticipate a most rapid radicalization and revolutionization of this American working class. The whole history of this working class has been to move, when they do move, massively, and to adopt the most revolutionary forms of struggle and organization. Didn't they do that in the great eruption that created the CIO within a period of a few years? And the whole previous experience of the working class has been such as to vindicate our confidence that when this working class begins to move, it will move at a tempo, at a truly American tempo. truly American empire. We have no competitors as revolutionists in this country. None. A few sick, sorry sects like progressive labor. Walter's idiot. Yaw. This YSA and this party, we've got a good start on the whole goddamn kit and caboodle of them, and we're not going to relinquish our advantage. We've got the cotter, we've got the youth, and whoever has the youth has the workers. Don't ever let anybody tell you differently that the road to work to the working class has got to be one by one and in a factory and becoming a proletarian. We don't have any objection to that. That's a slow way of doing it, but but I remember what happened in the 30s. The Communist Party had the youth. And when the opportunities developed, they took their youth corps, their youth cadre, and they sent them into the union, not as workers in the shop, but as leaders. Yes. If you please, union leaders, right off the campus of Berkeley. I remember this character, they sent him to, made him, what's his name, of the ILW, who's a big shot now. I remember he was that high. Oh, don't laugh. Don't laugh. They almost took over the CIO. If they had a revolutionary party and program, they would have taken over the CIO. We'd had a different history in this country. No, but they went for people's frontism, you know, in 1935. And they sold the union movement down the river. And they cut their own throat. We've got the youth, and that means we've got the future. The revolutionary future, and that's the only future for the working class in this country. And let me tell you, so far as the revolutionary development in this world is concerned, every revolutionary victory is only tentative, incomplete, until the American Revolution. So long as American imperialism exists, the threat of nuclear annihilation hangs over humanity on a world scale, regardless of how many partial victories are gained, and each are important, that the final decision will be here in this country. And it's going to be the YSA and the Socialist Workers' Party is going to lead this revolution to a victory, the final victory of humanity, and a real brotherhood of men and women for the first time in history. Choir sister? That's all you want? You said your say.
You can take the question. We just want to ask that the questions or comments be kept as short as possible because of the time.
Okay.
How would you characterize the Republican country in the period from 1945 to 1948 where it was under the
from 45 to 48? How would you characterize the buffer countries, that is Eastern Europe, from the period 1945, that is the end of the war, and the formation of the coalition governments until 1948-49, when these coalition governments were overthrown. But we characterize them as transitional regimes. Transitional to what? We left the question open. We didn't know. They were capitalists, you see. We didn't designate them the farm worker state until after the coalition regimes had been overthrown. We recognized that they were based upon capitalist property relations. And they did not fit into the criteria that we've established for designating a state as a worker state. These are capitalist states, but they're transition states because they are under the military domination of the Red Army. There's a possibility that Stalin would trade them off in a deal with American imperialism. That's why he set them up, the coalition regimes. That's what he did in France. You know, the French Communist Party had the power as the head of the resistance movement, and Italy too. After they strung Mussolini up by the heels, the Italian Communist Party had the power. But the policy of the Stalin was the coalition, you see. That is, not to take the power, but to enter into a coalition, which he did in France and in Italy, until the Cold War broke out, and then they booted the Communist Party out of power. So it wasn't excluded that he would trade off for some other concession, these states in Eastern Europe. But with the Cold War, that changed everything, you see. And there was a temporary swing to the left. And then, as I say, after a rather lengthy discussion, we arrived at the formula of deformed worker states in Eastern Europe.
The American working world have a slight flirtation with residents of the United States, in particular with Thomas Hart. It might be possible, given the time limit, to elaborate a little bit more on that.
Yeah, I think that the Communist Party, I think I explained yesterday, is gaining numbers now on the basis of a reformist program. That is, they're attracting youngsters, primarily, not workers, not many blacks, primarily on the basis of a reformist program. As when young people, especially those who are not industrial workers or in the working class or have not imbibed the class, the consciousness of workers on jobs, when they develop a political consciousness, they don't leap immediately to the extreme revolutionary position. They're attracted to what they consider a very radical position, a supportive peace candidate, the anti-monopoly coalition, a peaceful coexistence, and so forth. And so on. This sounds like pretty good stuff to them, until after they've gone through a certain experience, you see. But when the workers see a different problem, when the workers become radicalized, they're going to become radicalized on the basis of the capitalist class not being able to grant any further concessions, but the capitalist class, because of its inherent contradictions, at one stage or another is going to have to begin taking away concessions from the workers. Concessions that have previously won, it's going to be very hard to do. You see, the working class fights much harder to retain those advantages and concessions previously won than it does to win new concessions. Always is a historical fact, you see. So the character of their struggle itself will determine the degree of their radicalization. That is not true, by the way, of the way we're recruiting or the way the Communist Party is recruiting individuals here and there. Recruiting on the basis of their intellectual development, you see, to their degree of intellectual development and understanding of the historical process. So they'll recruit, that's not fatal, but they're not going to recruit revolutionaries. They're not going to make revolutionaries. They'll make young opportunists. Young maneuverers and manipulators, you never make a revolution with those two.
If I remember correctly, the period of the party that was the first band for the name of Palmiro Togliatti, a the science city. And the question is, Emory is kind of part of here, why is it kind of old? Oh, it's another example of a farmed out job, when it's probably directed to sort of experiments.
No, I don't think so.
And the second part is, was the Social Workers' Party able to perceive the arrival of the
Were we able to what?
Perceive a theoretical
justification
of what was happening at that time among the
Well, yes, we could see it from the very beginning. It's inherent in the whole concept. As I stated before, if it's valid to say you can build socialism in one country in the Soviet Union, why not another country? And Trotsky makes that very point, I think, in his criticism of the draft program, in his book. He says, sure, the moment you have that, you have a conflict, you see. And that's what happened. That is, they refused to subordinate the development, the industrial, economic development of their own country to building socialism in the Soviet Union. The Chinese objected to that very vigorously, I recall. Subordinate their development of their own economy, their own industrial development, their own agriculture, because they're going to build communism, wait until they build communism in the Soviet Union. The whole idea of competitive coexistence, that's the same idea is behind it, that wait, they say, wait until the Soviet Union develops its productive plant equipment, its capacity, its productivity of labor to the point where it can produce commodities cheaper than any of the more advanced capitalist countries, and then the whole capitalist system will fall like a ripe plum right into the laps of the Soviets. So that'll be the day. That'll be the day. And so they say, they said, we're going to catch up with the Khrushchev, that we're going to catch up and outstrip the 1970, did he say? Mao, remember, in the Great Leap Forward, they said that they were going to catch up and outstrip Great Britain. They were a little more modest. He said Soviet Union. Great Britain by 1970. Well, it's such illusions. They've got to project these, you see, in order to make the workers continue to sacrifice the present for this utopian future.
Trotsky's role in the government to betray is something very unclear. That is that he said there are certain specific conditions in the transitional period between capitalism and socialism, that of problems of distribution of the goods produced, the inequality and the stratification of labor, and so on and so forth, that the bureaucracy
would have
to exist in certain periods of time. Now, I don't understand that, and I'd like to
go into it. Well, I don't know whether you have an exact quote. See, it will always be necessary up until the time that you have a classless society. An administrative bureaucracy would always be necessary in the transitional period, wouldn't it? How else would you organize the distribution of commodities under a workers' state? You'd have to have an administrative bureaucracy. These administrators would constitute a bureaucracy, but a bureaucracy in the good sense, not a bureaucratic caste that controls and usurps the democratic rights of the workers and imposes its interests and privileges and power upon the state. In a healthy worker, you had a bureaucracy in the period of Lenin and Trotsky. Unfortunately, it was a bureaucracy based upon a prevailing, generalized poverty. They didn't have much to distribute. Well, let me get on this side. Then we're on this side. Tom?
Marxian idea, I believe, of the work of state would include the state as a body of armed men, and where the Red Army is, there is the work of state. And then, the way this would apply to Eastern Europe would be that since they at the moment they had the Red Army occupying the land, they would be already considered work of state. And sort of used, want to demonstrate the flaw in that type of
You mean you want me to demonstrate the fly in that ointment? Well, that's not precisely the Marcy I position. That position is a very simplistic one, a very schematic one. It says it's based upon what they call the global class struggle. That is, the world is divided into two classes. On the one side stand the workers' states and their allies, the communist parties and the revolutionary radicals. On the other side stand the capitalist states, you see. And they support the side of the angels. So that they identify Stalinism in power, you see, as being in our class camps. They say the two class camps, the revolutionary camp and the capitalist camp. So that when the Hungarian Revolution came along, for example, they supported the intervention of Soviet troops. They supported the Soviet Union sending tanks into Hungary to crush the revolution because Hungary was part of the Soviet bloc, which was in our camp, don't you see? And so that any revolution in Hungary must be a revolution against our camp, therefore it must be counter-revolutionary, and they justify the destruction. It's a very simplistic view of the division of the world into two camps, you see, which is, happens to be much more complicated and complex.
Yes, sir. It's nice. Well, do we actually attribute that it is in Germany in 1923 to the policies of Stalin, or that was just the failure of the communist party in Germany itself? Because by that time, Stalin wasn't really controlling the country.
Well, Stalin was controlling the Comintern by virtue of the fact that Zinoviev was then chairman of the Comintern, and Zinoviev was in a block with Stalin. No, Trotsky points out, I think, in his criticism of the draft program, he cites direct evidence, a letter which Stalin sent to Zinoviev, in which Stalin admonishes Zinoviev to restrain the German Communist Party for this policy. Keep him back. Keep him on the check leash. Do not let him proceed to struggle for power. No, it was the policy of the Comintern under Zinoviev and Stalin, under the centrist bureaucracy, that curbed the German party. Of course, they had in the German party elements which were amenable to being curbed. They didn't have genuine revolutionary Bolsheviks. And so it was a successful and easy operation. Way up there, okay.
In the case of Yugoslavia, what are some of the reasons why Yugoslavia turned out as a foreign worker state, essentially a Stalin?
As a what?
A foreign worker state, essentially a Stalin state, rather than something like Cuba. That is, excuse me, unlike the Soviet Union, Tito's bureaucracy didn't come to power based on the lines of a revolution already.
Well, that's not quite a true picture of Tito's past. I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. Tito was a Stalinist hatchet man for most of his political life. Tito matriculated in the Spanish Revolution. Tito was one of those men that Stalin sent into Spain to destroy the Spanish Revolution. He did a pretty good job before he went back to Moscow and then to Yugoslavia. He was a Stalinist from the very beginning. But under the pressure, after he went back to Yugoslavia, under the pressure of a surging armed movement of partisans, you see, in a civil war in which he was given no alternative but to be destroyed or to destroy his opponent, he emerged victorious in the civil war and found himself in power, but along with a whole Stalinist baggage from the very beginning. He never established Soviets. Never established workers' democracy, never had a democratic communist party in Yugoslavia. No. That's why we designated it as a deformed workers' state. Cuba, we said, was a tell me what you said, even though it did not emerge from a from the leadership of a Marxist revolutionary party, but in the process developed the revolution along the line of the permanent revolution. Now, it has, see, the Cuban Revolution had deformations, and one was the lack of institutionalized form of workers' democracy. Castro tried to compensate for that by holding these massive meetings of hundreds of thousands, a million would turn out to where he'd give a report, but that's a poor substitute, you see, because you have no opportunity of expressing an opposing point of view in that kind of a plebiscite. You can either say yes or no, and usually it's a foregone conclusion that when such a meeting is held, yes is going to be the answer. So it's a very poor substitute, and that's why they found themselves in such a problem with such difficulties now. And he's going to have to cast about and find other forms of involving the workers in the determination of the plan and carrying out the plan. Otherwise, he's going to stumble from one crisis to another, I'm afraid, and may result in the degeneration of that state. Now, on this side, just pardon me. Is there anyone on this side? All right. Seems this side is the more active side.
Certain sections of the youth movement today are not officially connected with either progressive labor or the PC. One finds among certain elements, you know, a resurgence of Stalinism, very Stalin button reading to, you know, works and adulation of them. Could you comment on that?
I'm afraid that my vocabulary doesn't permit me to offer adequate comment. I don't know. Some go for pot, some go for Stalin. What's this? That's the way they get their kicks. I don't know. There's no rational explanation. Clashing interests of these two bureaucratic castes. That's the only material interest at work. It certainly would not be to either the advantage of the Soviet workers and peasants or the Chinese workers and peasants. Engaged in a war over who's going to control a few miles of territory. I don't think it's very likely. I say that, well, you, me in the press, you read the characterizations of each other. There is no episode too extreme for the Maoist applies to the Kremlin, and vice versa. They call them fascists. They say capitalism has been destroyed. They're in the collusion with American imperialism to destroy China, and so forth and so forth and so on. All the ideological basis is certainly laid for any kind of a military confrontation. They've already had military confrontations and conflict in certain border areas, haven't they? And despite what they would wish, even if they don't want to get into a big war, that's the way a lot of wars start, you know. Little ones become big ones. Yes? I can't hear you. Well, either of them tried to reestablish an international organization, and the closest thing to it have been these conferences that have been called in Moscow. There's one in 60, I think, another one in 61 or 62, one even more recently. Conferences in which they all gather together and then adopt a statement or a program which has a little bit in it for everybody. You know, you have to satisfy. In order to get them together, you have to make concessions. Everything is decided before they get together. Because a lot of them won't attend until it is, you see. But, they have no more illusions about any democracy that they're going to get than the Soviet worker has or the Soviet intellectuals who are now in prison because they dare to criticize. So that has been the substitute. Recently, it's taken the form of an attempt on the part of Moscow to mobilize the communist parties of the world against Peking. Now, Peking hasn't tried to do likewise. I don't think it's mobilized very much throughout the world as it did. I don't know what useful purpose it would serve. Otherwise, how do these parties arise? Most of the Maoist formations arise out of splits in the communist parties. That's my general impression throughout the world. That's the way it happened here, by and large. Split off. There is no uniformity in the Maoist movement. Maoist groups who are at each other's throats, you see. There's no consistent philosophy, idea, program, except Mao's thoughts, and everybody can subscribe to Mao's thoughts and cut each other's throat at the same moment, you see, and be entirely consistent. All right, you? All right. Well, on the first question, I don't know more any more about it probably than you do, and that's what I've read in international press and compilations of the material that they've been able to smuggle out of the Soviet Union. It seems to me a very significant, a symptomatic, rather than numerically significant. It doesn't appear as though the workers are affected, at least there's no overt manifestation. I think that within the Soviet Union, the question of the development of the political revolution will depend largely on what happens outside of the Soviet Union. That is why, for example, they reacted brutally to the Czechoslovak development, where they sent mobilized token forces from the other reformed workers' states, but primarily the Soviet armed forces sent in to crush what they considered an incipient threat to their own position. That if they permitted this so-called liberalization in Czechoslovakia, it would begin to spread beyond the borders of Czechoslovakia and infiltrate into the Soviet Union and create the basis for a movement that could constitute a danger to their own prestige and power. And so they formulated a theory of limited sovereignty, I think is what they call it, Brezhnev theory of limited